This week on Behind the Lens, climate catastrophes are fueling a mental health crisis. The Lens collaborated with the Center for Public Integrity and Columbia Journalism Investigations on this project with newsrooms around the country. We'll hear from Dean Russell, who co-wrote the story. Marta Jusen will fill us in on a defamation suit brought by a former administrator for Abramson Sci Academy, whose email to teachers at the school made the news last year due to what looked at first glance like a potential grade-changing scheme. The administrator says the email was innocuous. She was following her charter network's policy, and she accuses the network of throwing her under the bus. And last week, the New Orleans City Council passed a non-binding resolution calling for judges at Orleans Parish Criminal District Court to stop imposing conviction fees and to return fine and fee funds they've collected from defendants in court. But the resolution could be in violation of state law. Nick Krastel will break it down for us. Those stories, analysis, and insight coming up on Behind the Lens. On the pod this week, education reporter Marta Jusen is back from vacation. Welcome back, Marta.
Thank you.
Criminal justice reporter Nick Krastel's here. Hey, Nick.
Hey, man.
And we're joined by editor of The Lens, Charles Maldonado. Thanks for being here, Charles.
Morning. Thank you.
First up today, we spoke with Dean Russell, a reporter for Columbia Journalism Investigations, a news team based at Columbia University, where he covers climate change and public health. Russell, along with Jamie Smith Hopkins, a senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, wrote the story. From climate-fueled storms to COVID-19, mounting catastrophes are sowing stress and trauma. The country's one program designed to respond reaches only a fraction of survivors. Dean, tell everybody what the federal government's response team is and what they do.
You know, when a disaster strikes, and that could really be anything from a terrorist attack to an epidemic, the federal government has really one program meant to help disaster survivors cope with their experiences. It's called the Crisis Counseling Program. It's essentially a year-long grant that states can apply for after a major disaster declaration. It's funded by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. You know, just to give you an idea, in the last three decades, it gives out about $24 million a year. That's about 1% of FEMA's disaster relief budget. What it really does is funds state hotlines, crisis hotlines, public awareness campaigns about mental health. And most importantly, it funds crisis counselors who, until the pandemic hit, would go into communities after a disaster. They would offer help in person, sometimes door to door, sometimes in the parking lot of Walmart. The idea here isn't really therapy so much as it is giving survivors someone to talk to, showing them rudimentary coping skills, if needed, helping them find more intensive mental health care. Louisiana, for example, has used CCP to respond to about 15 disasters in the last 30 years, and it's been awarded over $100 million. That's more than any other state except for New York, and a lot of that is because of Katrina.
Yeah, following up on that for a second, the intention is for the government's response to be funneled to the states that then allocate it how they see fit. Is there any accountability about how that money actually gets spent?
Yeah, actually, you know, it is interesting, and this is what led to a lot of our findings, was that they do have a system in place. Some might actually say a little too rigorous to study basically what the effect of CCP was.
Okay.
You know, so when a disaster hits, states have to submit sometimes gigantic grant proposals, which is, you know, not the norm in terms of getting FEMA aid. Iowa, for example, sent in a CCP application that was like 168 pages for their last disaster. And then after they deploy CCP, they actually have to send a report that says everything that they did, where the money went to. If they didn't use all of the money, they have to give it back. And kind of most importantly, in the last 10 or so years, they started tracking the number of survivors that they offer crisis counseling and other services to. So that's one way in which they can be held accountable. You know, it is the government. There are always things that kind of slip through the cracks, but there's a decent amount of documentation that goes into what CCP does.
Were you able to glean, Dean, through your reporting, benchmarks of susceptibility to feeling acute trauma or stress from natural disasters?
So one thing I'll say just generally is, for example, the percentage of a population that's affected by, mentally affected by a natural disaster really does vary based off of the disaster, based off the population, based off of the geography. You know, one review of multiple studies found that between 30 and 40% of disaster survivors developed post-traumatic symptoms.
Wow.
For many of those, the symptoms do decrease over time. You know, one often cited study out of Hurricane Katrina found that suicidal thoughts doubled to about 6% after that event. But again, every disaster is unique in its size and its intensity. Was it deadly? Did it put people out of work or destroy homes? How many years has it been since the storm hit? And then who was hardest hit? You know, studies have found that lower income communities, neighborhoods of color, single mothers, children, those already dealing with mental health or substance abuse issues tend to fare worse, and the effects tend to linger longer. So one study of low-income mothers affected by Hurricane Katrina found that about 1 in 6 had PTSD symptoms 12 years after the storm, so they can really linger. But then to your point about recurring disasters, this is something that researchers are just beginning to look at. It's tough to get hard data because it requires following a population regularly
right.
over a number of years, but there's some emerging evidence that suggests that it lengthens the time that it takes to heal. You know, less threatening storms that come later feel like apocalyptic events, and we heard this repeatedly from survivors. You know, for example, a survey out of Rice University in Texas found that 30% of its respondents experienced emotional distress from Tropical Storm Imelda in 2019. But most of those respondents linked, you know, the beginnings of that stress to their experience with Hurricane Harvey. So they have an event, it creates this emotional distress, and then repeated disasters just make it so that they can't heal. It's a lengthening process more than anything, repeated disasters.
What are some of the barriers that prevent people from seeking help?
We heard time and time again from survivors, from, you know, I actually heard it a lot from communities of color, that there's a stigma to talking about your feelings, to talking about the emotional hell it really is to go through this. You know, one survivor told me that, you know, people talk about mental health like you're crazy, but it's not about that. It's about finding peace, she said. And there's definitely a stigma, and it prevents people from going out there seeking help when they have the ability to do that.
You write about climate and mental health. Does this worry you, the contributing factor of climate change to these types of events?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting. We started looking at this because of climate change, and then early on, then coronavirus kind of popped up and became one of the bigger focuses. But, just to stick with climate change, what we know is, you know, for example, in the early, in mid-20th century, about fewer than 20% of U.S. counties experienced a disaster every year. So fewer than 20%. Today, it's more like 50%.
Wow.
It's high. According to the 2018 National Climate Assessment, which comes out from the U.S. government, climate change is already driving more severe storms, floods, wildfires in the U.S. We know that's true. Those studies will come out about Hurricane Laura and the wildfires right now in the West, but they're a picture to a lot of climate scientists of what we can expect more of in the future. I think what climate change ultimately means is that more communities will experience disaster. Those disasters will become more destructive, and some communities are experiencing repeat disasters. You know, in the last 5 years, Louisiana has made 8 major disaster declarations for storms or floods, many of those in the same places. And that does have an effect on people's mental well-being.
Yeah, that leads me to my final question. We're speaking on Wednesday morning, and Hurricane Laura is bearing down on the Texas and Louisiana coast right now. Unclear if it's going to be a Category 3 or Category 4. In the article, you call Texas a bellwether state, and you write, in the last 10 years, the state faced 15 federally declared major disasters for storms or wildfires, 6 in the Houston area alone. In looking at the data, it looks like Puerto Rico has 3 times the number of respondents as that of Texas, and an order of magnitude more than the number of respondents from Louisiana. Why do you think that is? How do you account for that disparity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. You know, first, I'll just note about the survey. It's not a scientific survey, so, you know, we didn't do random sampling or anything like that. It was really just a call out to survivors to say, hey, tell us what you went through. There's no clear answer. I would say that my guess, based off of talking to many of these survivors, is that Puerto Rico, much like survivors from New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, Puerto Ricans felt really left behind after Hurricane Maria. You know, I think there's this feeling of being forgotten and wanting to let people know that this tragedy is still happening. It's really just, you know, it's a question mark on why more people from Puerto Rico responded to our survey. It could speak to just, you know, who read the survey, but it could also mean that, you know, people there want to tell their story really badly because they feel forgotten.
Right. You could extrapolate, though, I'm sure, from the data. The experiences are human. And we have these experiences that collectively unite us.
That's why we relied not only on this survey, but on epidemiological studies over the years, which have sent researchers out into the field, knocking door to door to hear from those communities, those vulnerable communities. You know, there's no one answer for how to collect this data or even what the data will tell you. But we, you know, as you said, these experiences are human. And you know, it came up just so much in my reporting. I talked to dozens and dozens of survivors and heard some of the same stories over and over again. Each one was emotional and tragic in a lot of ways and uplifting in some ways, but they were so similar. Even people who went through a wildfire in California had a very similar experience to those in Puerto Rico who went through Hurricane Maria. At least emotionally, they did.
Right. It's a great story and so timely and very tragic for that, too. But thank you so much for your time, Dean.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dean Russell is a reporter for Columbia Journalism Investigations, a news team based at Columbia University, where he covers climate change and public health. Russell, along with Jamie Smith Hopkins, a senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, wrote the story. You can see the whole thing on their website, thelensnola.org. This story was published in partnership with the Center for Public Integrity and Columbia Journalism Investigations. All right, Marta, before we get to your major story, you have some breaking news.
We do expect there to be a schools announcement on reopening and whether or not schools will continue in New Orleans virtually or in person or a hybrid model of that on Friday. The district is holding a press conference at noon, so we'll be excited to bring you that. This is, I think, them just keeping their promise and updating us on what the COVID case counts look like and whether or not they're going to be comfortable reopening schools to children.
Okay. And then the big story that you were working on this week involved a defamation suit brought by a former administrator. Tell everybody the kind of broad strokes of the story.
What happened last fall is there was an assistant principal at one of the Collegiate Academy schools who, after many months of things happening at Kennedy with grade changing reports, when this email that she sent went out with the subject line of "fix your grade books," I think that really caught a lot of people's eyes, including some of the teachers who reported to her. You know, they initially said that was something they weren't comfortable with. She did continue working at the school, but received a lot of press coverage about those specific words. And then she also had in that email a line to the tune of, well, we don't want to cook the books. You know, that's kind of a line you don't really want to see in an email anyways, probably. But, well, she did continue at the school. What happened this summer is that she's now unable to find a job, and she says it's due to that press coverage, which included the superintendent calling her email unacceptable.
So she, in her job pursuits, that sort of triggered the lawsuit?
That's what it sounds like. She is now unable to find a job, so she is suing Collegiate Academies and the district, saying that this press coverage, or what they said to the press, that the press reported, has made that very difficult for her to find a job. And in fact, her lawyer is arguing that she was just following charter school policy when she sent that email.
Oh, boy. There was a lot of national attention given to the John F. Kennedy High School grade scheme, the grade inflation scheme. You did a lot of reporting around that around the same time. How is this situation different or similar?
So what is different about it is it does appear that she was following the protocol and the policy and the kind of established practices at her network. What happened at Kennedy appeared to be employees really, you know, acting outside of policy and even state law at times. But now here back at Collegiate, this assistant principal says she was doing things that other employees have been doing for years.
Yeah, and I think Kennedy, which Marta reported on a lot in 2019, is kind of the reason that this story, you know, made news coverage and made fairly big featured news coverage on television, because this happened right in the wake of the Kennedy scandal. And the Kennedy scandal, for people who aren't familiar, we initially reported on what appeared to be, or Marta rather reported on what appeared to be a series of improper grade changes that were happening at Kennedy. This reporting and the fallout from it sort of triggered a chain reaction at the school. After that initial report, there was a series of investigations. There were a number of administrators who were fired or quit, and the investigations ended up uncovering, you know, all sorts of mismanagement at the school. And about half the graduating class in 2019 was unable to graduate on time as a result of some of this mismanagement. Now, as far as we know, nothing similar was happening at Abramson Psi Academy, but that's sort of the context here. Was Kennedy was in the news when the Abramson Psi story came out.
All right, so but they're saying that this is not that. This is a means to try to have parity or kind of correct for prejudices in grading somehow. Explain the justification or the policy that they use.
Right, so it appears that the network had established some of these policies, or goals is how they describe them in their policies, of having a certain number or percentage of students in each class get an A, a certain percent get a B, a certain percent get a C, and less than 10% getting a D or an F. And when you read through kind of their background of that, what you seem to realize is that they are trying to acknowledge that Black and Brown students can be graded unfairly in the system that's currently set up, and that if those grades are what translate to your work after high school or your ability to get into college, then that's something that they want to correct. And this does kind of get into this, you know, we're kind of in murky water with this word goal. Is that something that teachers are expected to meet, or is that something that, you know, they should take a look at? And if their class doesn't look like that breakdown, then maybe they're doing something wrong. So I think that's one of the really big questions here.
Is this issue about sort of, you know, racial parity in grading, is that something that's been explicitly said by the network itself, or is that something that this administrator sort of, this is sort of her interpretation as outlined in her lawsuit against the school?
She provides documents in the lawsuit that explain why the network had set up these goals. So I do believe a lot of this came from the network. There are specific instances where they analyze their own average GPA and they say, hey, we need to bring up the GPAs of our students. And so whether or not that's, you know, just a boost to teachers, or a, hey, let's change the grading system, I think is a really big question.
that's a question I had. There are a couple of words in here that, you know, this all kind of hinges on the definition. When it said our goal is to have 90% of our students get C's or better, is that goal, and does that mean goal in the traditional sense of, you know, if everybody's doing their job right, we aspire, you know, we believe
right.
that this should be the case, or is it a goal in the sense that this has to happen, you know, by whatever means?
Numbers need to be changed to meet that goal.
Right, and the
right.
lawyer who, you know, the plaintiff in this defamation suit against the Charter Network brings up an interesting point in the lawsuit. There is somewhat less job security for faculty at charter schools than maybe there had been in the past at traditional schools where there was, you know, district-wide union representation and established rules about due process and all that sort of thing in a collective bargaining agreement. A lot of charter school faculty have, you know, a bit less job security, and the ultimate lack of job security is the fact that the schools are closed fairly often in New Orleans based on their performance. You know, the question, I guess, is even if this is a goal in the traditional sense, is it kind of treated as a mandate, you know, regardless?
One thing, or one kind of nuanced thing that we also should address is that, you know, teachers have had their own grading scales for years, and this is at schools across the country. You know, I can remember being in school, and if every student on a certain test, you know, got like 70 or 80% of the answers wrong, a teacher might throw out that quiz and say, well, hey, that was a bad quiz. So there's definitely room for, you know, changing the weight of assignments and changing grades. The one thing that I'll note that is in Louisiana law is that the teacher themselves is supposed to be responsible for this. And administration is only allowed to step in if they see a serious problem that is outlined in the law, or if a teacher's grade for one student in particular does not match how they graded other students. So if you have an administrator emailing you, you know, the week before grades are due saying fix your grade book, that kind of goes back to what Charles was discussing with, you know, what does a goal really mean?
Yeah, and I think in this case, the argument is being made that this is an application of policy rather than what something like we saw at Kennedy, which was simply taking, oh, this person got an F, let's change it to a D, where this was being applied, this was policy that she says was being applied across classes and classrooms. It'll be interesting to see what happens in this lawsuit.
Yeah, it's a great story. Thank you, Marta.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ann Muller, Chief Operating Officer at The Lens. The Lens aims to engage and empower the residents of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. If you'd like the inside scoop on what stories we're pursuing, what events and initiatives are coming up, and to learn more about the people who report at The Lens, subscribe today to our newsletter at thelensnola.org/newsletters. Thank you.
Nick, last week, the New Orleans City Council passed a non-binding resolution calling for judges at Orleans Parish Criminal District Court to stop imposing conviction fees and to return fine and fee funds they've collected from defendants in court. It's not binding, and it's normally something we would have ignored or folded into a larger story, but this one had some unusual features. Try to explain for us.
Yeah, so the city has put out a resolution, which is a non-binding resolution. It's not a legal document, but it just states the city council's intention. And the subject of the resolution is the money that the criminal court collects in fines and fees. So these are fees that criminal defendants pay following their conviction or a guilty plea, as well as a portion of money that they pay to commercial bail bondsmen. So what the city council passed last week was a resolution saying that, one, the judges should stop assessing these fines and fees. Two, that the city would not accept the money from fines and fees. And that, three, the judges should return the fines and fees that they've collected over the last 2 years back to defendants, which is over $500,000. So that right there is a fairly bold resolution, despite the fact that it's
non-binding.
As you mentioned, there are some questions about whether or not if the judges and if the city went forward with what the council is proposing, whether or not that would be in violation of certain state laws.
So why now? What's the impetus to issue this non-binding resolution today?
Well, so traditionally, the way the court was set up was that these fines and fees went back into something that was called a judicial expense fund. So they went to the court, and the court used them to pay for certain costs. They paid for, you know, supplies and salaries of staffers. The one thing it couldn't pay for was the salaries of judges. But in 2018, two federal judges ruled that was unconstitutional, that the judges, when they were determining if someone had an ability to pay these fines and fees, had a conflict of interest, because ultimately those fines and fees were going to benefit the court.
How did that finding happen?
Yeah, there were two civil rights suits filed, class action suits, one against the magistrate judge, who is the one primarily responsible for setting bail, and then one against the rest of the criminal court judges for assessing conviction fees.
Okay.
So, yeah, you know, these two lawsuits were in 2018, but this conflict of interest is something that people have been talking about for decades. So it is why now. It's hard to say. It's the product of these two lawsuits. But following these judges' rulings in the most recent legislative session, in order to sort of fix this conflict of interest, the state legislature passed a law that would direct that the money from those fines and fees not into the judicial expense fund as it traditionally was put into, but mandated the judges to forward that money to the city. So normally the city would have no say in how this money is being collected or being used, but due to this new state law, they now actually have some say and some leverage in deciding what happens. Although the state law dictates that money be used by the city to go to criminal justice related issues, basically.
Right. And I think, I mean, importantly in the state law, I think they were trying to preemptively address criticisms of this, you know, of what was intended as a fix here, because the law as it reads doesn't say that the money goes back into the courts. It's supposed to go back to defray the costs of administering a criminal justice system in Orleans Parish, which a lot of people after this passed were concerned that, okay, well, the city's going to hold on to this money for a minute and then just pass all of it back onto the courts. So we've essentially got the same system, but we've got sort of an arbitrary intermediary. And I think part of what the council is saying here is, no, we're not going to do that. We're not even going to take this money and control it. We don't want to have anything to do with this money, and we don't think it should be imposed in the first place. As for why now, I think it's a combination of things. I think with the events that have happened over the summer across the country, the council has been trying to show that it's concerned with criminal justice reform in a way that making it a priority that it maybe hasn't been as much in the past. And the other issue is that we are getting close to city budgeting season, which I think is, you know, when the rubber meets the road on a lot of these things that the council is saying that they're doing.
Critics of the state law that sort of just transfer this money say, you know, sure, this fixed the conflict of interest, but there's an inherent injustice in assessing fines and fees and funding, you know, the criminal justice system, whether it's through the court or through the city, on the backs of defendants who are mostly poor and mostly Black. And that's something that is separate from the conflict of interest issue.
Right. So, and in that regard, as it speaks to criminal justice reform, it kind of dovetails with the public defender funding ordinance, which you recently reported on.
Yeah, it does. So the public defender parity ordinance was an ordinance that mandated that the city budget provide 85% of funding to the public defenders that it does to the district attorney's office. And the substance of the ordinance in this resolution are fairly different, but the idea that the public defender shouldn't be relying on money from fines and fees, which are oftentimes unreliable and fluctuate quite a bit, and should have this solid chunk of money given to them, is a big part of what that ordinance was trying to get at. You know, that ordinance, similarly to this one, there's questions about whether or not it will, once the budgeting negotiations start happening, how enforceable it is, and whether or not the city council and the mayor's office are really going to have to stick to that ordinance. So there's some similarities there as well.
Just to get into, you know, a little bit of civics background here, what Nick reported on this week, this resolution. Resolutions are typically, you know, as we mentioned, non-binding, and they're usually just kind of statements of principle more than anything. The parity ordinance with the public defenders is technically it's a law. You know, it goes into the city code. The potential trouble with that one is that the city budget is also passed in an ordinance. Neither one kind of trumps the other one, except for the fact that, you know, the budget is where you actually decide where the money goes. You know, we have another part of city law that demands a certain level of funding for one city agency, and that's the Inspector General's office, except that mandate is contained in the charter. Charter is similar to the Constitution. It's, you know, it's like the Constitution for the city, so it's the foundational law. So if you have a funding requirement in the charter, that's going to trump everything else. This is just ordinance versus ordinance, or in the case of what Nick reported on this week, resolution versus ordinance, and which is you know, even less enforceable in that it's not really enforceable at all. Now,
okay.
Generally, if Nick comes to me with a pitch about a resolution in city council, I'm going to say, who cares? Except in this case, the resolution contained both explicit instructions and an explicit threat. And Nick, I don't know if you want to talk about that part of it at all.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, what the city council said is that for every dollar of fines and fees that the judges assess, they are going to deduct $2 from their budget. So this is a, you know, a way to...
That's a big stick.
Yeah, to really encourage and incentivize the judges not to assess these fines and fees. What the judges would say is that they have to. By state law, they are mandated to assess certain fines and fees. They have discretion in some of them. In conviction fees, they can find that a defendant is too poor to pay for them and can relieve them. But when it comes to bond fees, they actually have very little discretion. If someone buys a commercial bail bond, 2% of that premium goes to this fund that the judges hold on to and are supposed to pass on to the city, and they really have very little say. So, you know, that threat is something that the Criminal Justice Committee sort of discussed, and how to navigate these discretionary fees versus less discretionary fees, and isn't really something that I've gotten a clear answer on how they're going to do. And I would just say, you know, despite it being a resolution, one of the sort of extraordinary things about it to me is this idea that they would return this over $500,000 back to individual defendants who have already paid them out. And that, if it were to actually happen, I think that would be quite unique and I think interesting if it happened.
Are we also setting up a potential scenario where these two entities are going to be in litigating this issue?
That's a good question. I mean, I think probably both the city council, the mayor's office, and the judges aren't interested in that, and which is why this is a resolution, and it gives them some room to kind of work things out once budgeting comes. But I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I think the important thing to remember with this and the parity ordinance is that we're really not going to know if the council means what it says until we see the vote on the budget.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, the way that these two, both the ordinance and the resolution, were passed, they were passed very quietly without really any debate in front of the full council. And, you know, I don't know what that suggests, whether or not it means that the council feels like they have, you know, a lot of room to deviate from what they said they intended, or if they feel so certain about their intentions that they didn't need to discuss it. So I think we'll find out.
Thanks for the hard work on that. It's very complex.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Thank you. Bye. This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guests this week, Marta Jusen, Nick Krastel, Lens editor Charles Maldonado, and special guest Dean Russell from Columbia Journalism Investigations, where he covers climate and health. You can read all the week's other news along with opinions at our website, thelensnola.org. Stay safe. See you next week.